Now, there's another significant consideration for this particular episode where the Lord appears with the two angels to commune with Abraham, and it shows the covenant relationship in the sharing of the meal with one another, but there's also a demonstration of the covenant relationship in that the Lord determines to consult with Abraham, in a sense. And he even says, you know, it's almost like, you know, they're taking their leave, and then he says, I really ought to tell Abraham what's coming up here, you know, because I'm in this covenant relationship with him. And he's needs to be privy to this information. And so what he says is, we're going down to Sodom because the report of the sin and degradation there is so great, and we're going there to confirm this. Okay. Now there's some what we call anthropomorphisms here. The very fact that God here is taking a kind of human form. Obviously, God doesn't have to go down and check this out. He knows what's going on there. It's kind of like with Babel. It says that the Lord said, let us go down. What is that way down there? That little, you know, tower? What's that way down there? Let's go down and see what they're doing down there. He knows what's going on there. But for the sake of humans and our human existence, oftentimes he communicates and relates in ways that are similar to human activity. And so this is what he does, and he conveys now to Abraham his intentions to see what is really happening in Sodom and Gomorrah, and to, you know, if the report is true, to destroy the city. And then commences this time of bargaining between Abraham and the Lord. And it's kind of like bartering. Abraham says, well, if there's 100 righteous people in that city, are you going to destroy the whole city, include them in it? And the Lord says, no, if there's 100, I won't. And he kind of takes them down by tens. But we see here Abraham interceding for others. And in a sense, he's already exercising his role of being a blessing to all nations in that he is interceding for others. In a sense, it's a kind of priesthood, a priestly role that he plays in his intercession for specifically Lot. That's who he's concerned with. Remember, he's already had to rescue Lot once from being captive. And so he finally gets them down to 10, and the Lord agrees, I won't destroy the city if there's 10 righteous people. Well, you know the rest of the story. The city is destroyed, showing that there aren't 10 righteous people there. And we don't have to go into the sordid details of the story, okay, as the two angels then go into Sodom. They are taken in by Lot, and the townsfolk, the men of the city, come out and knock on the door of Lot and say, bring out those two visitors who are staying in your home, because we would like to know them. Okay, and the term know in the Hebrew has a broader meaning than just kind of being acquaintance of. Frequently it's a sexual intimacy. Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth. So they're seeking to have homosexual rape, really, with these men. That shows just the degradation of the city. Now that's not all, because in the book of Ezekiel, it reveals to us that there are many other sins of the city of Sodom. But in this text in Genesis, that is most flagrant. And when you get to the book of Leviticus, homosexuality is an abomination to the Lord. Homosexual activity, I should say, is an abomination to the Lord. And so this is abominable to him as well. So the angels cast a blindness upon the townspeople, and they say to Lot and his wife and daughters, and the daughters are to go with as well, get out of here. And it's like the angels have to almost pull them out. Lot and his family have become so entrenched in this culture, and they've become so connected to it that they can't hardly leave it. I think that's a warning to us as well, that we don't get so rooted in our culture that as God calls us out, we are reluctant to leave the sin of the culture. Okay, and they practically have to drag them out of the city, but they say, don't look back. I think this is also indicative of this, you know, leave it behind. You're not to be connected with what's there, the trappings of that culture. And so they're leaving, and the fire and brimstone come down upon the cities. And Lot's wife, she turns around and turns into a pillar of salt. Okay. And this probably took place what is now the Dead Sea region, that valley, and it's a deadly, deathly area. Okay, the Dead Sea, as you're probably aware, is it's the lowest point on Earth in terms of sea level that is not in fact ocean. Okay. And it's lowest lake on Earth, below sea level, and so nothing drains out of it; it just evaporates out of it. You know, it has water that contributes to it, but it doesn't give, and so it's very salty. It's high salt element to it, and around the Sea of Dead Sea, I should say, there are many different kind of pillars of salt, natural formations. And it's very appropriate then that she turned into a pillar of salt. And if you go there as a tourist, they've got one that looks like a woman, and you can have a photograph next to Lot's wife if you like, okay? So, but that was her judgment. Well, the sordid story doesn't end there. So Lot and his daughters press on and move into the mountains and live in the caves. They essentially become troglodytes, okay, cavemen, cavewomen. I mean, it just shows how low they get. And the daughters are worried that they're not going to have husbands, they're not going to have children. And so they get dad drunk and have incestuous relations with him. And so the daughters then give birth, and their sons are named Moab and Ammon. Okay? And so these are of an incestuous relationship. Semites as well, of the line of Shem here. But these will then become the ancestors of the Moabites and the Ammonites, who become enemies of the Israelites later on. Okay, so I'm thinking. And yet, even so, we will hear of one Moabite woman, Ruth, who returns to faithful worship of the Lord. So even for these people who from the relation with Abraham, who are enemies of God's people and certainly do not call upon the name of the Lord, God's grace is for them, those who will turn to the Lord, be united into his community, covenant community, are accepted. These will be across the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan River, which is now the country of Jordan. In fact, the capital of Jordan is Amman, okay, Amman, Jordan. So it goes all the way back to that basis there. Okay, so that's Genesis chapter 19. Then in chapter 20, you have another incident, this time with a kind of a city-state king, Abimelech, the king of Gerar, in the region of the Philistines. And once again, Abraham has the subterfuge here of saying his wife, Sarah, is his sister and nothing more. And out of fear of what Abimelech might do to her. It's a pretty amazing thing that Abimelech would even be attracted to Sarah, because she's now 90 years old, okay? But some have speculated, the text doesn't necessarily say this, but apparently she's still very attractive, that there's kind of a rejuvenating of the promise for her here too, apparently, that she's very young. Text doesn't say that, but that seems to be the implication here. Okay? Finally then, in chapter 21, you have the birth of Isaac. Isaac is born here. And when Isaac is born, there's again this conflict between the other son of Abraham, which is Ishmael. Ishmael was probably larger than depicted here in this woodcut. He would probably be more like 13 or 14 at this time. And Isaac and his mother Sarah then, Sarah demands that Hagar be expelled. Abraham is reluctant, but expelled. So Hagar is off on her own with Ishmael. Out in the wilderness, the water runs dry in the sheepskin, kind of the canteen, if you will, runs dry. And she pleads to the Lord, we're just going to die out here in the desert. Lord, save us. And the Lord causes water to spring up, a fountain of water to spring up, which is a promise to her as well, that he's the God who hears, and the one who will be with her and sustain her and this other child of Abraham, this other son of Abraham, okay? And he also tells her that her son Ishmael will become great, will become a great leader, and that there will be times when people will try to subdue him, but he will, his descendants, his line. And today, the Arabs trace their lineage back to Ishmael, okay? He plays a very prominent role, for example, in some of the Muslim traditions and stories, okay? So, finally then, we come here to this kind of climax of the narrative about Abram, to chapter 22, and the sacrifice that God called Abram to. And I think it's good just to turn to chapter 22 and see what the Lord says here. It's a powerful, powerful passage. Verse 1, after these things, God tested Abraham. So there's a test that takes place in this covenant relationship. God is going to test him. And he said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. He, that is God, said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, so it's a three-day journey, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to the young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and worship and come to you." Okay? So, what we're going to do now is look at a video depiction of this powerful scene. Okay. If any of you have children, sons or daughters, that's very, very hard to see. I've got two boys about that age and size right now. But why was this such a challenge, other than obviously the parental love to kill your son? But why was this especially difficult for Abram to understand, to follow through on?
It's the son that's going to be his continuation.
Yeah.
He's already, at this time, 110, 115, depending on when it was.
Right.
He's already sent Ishmael into the desert to die, as far as he knows.
Right. Yeah. So it comes back to the covenant, the promise. God now has fulfilled his promise, and he said that it would be through Isaac that Abraham's offspring would be, the blessing would come. And then God says, now go and kill him, sacrifice him. Okay. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 11 once again, it says that by faith Abraham obeyed God in this command as well, because he believed that God could raise the dead. Okay. That God could raise the dead. Turn to Hebrews 11. Once again, we've already been there earlier today. This great chapter of the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Faith. Okay. And chapter 11, verse 17. By faith Abraham, in verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises, those covenant promises, was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." Now verse 19, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. In other words, Abraham had come to the point of accepting that his son would die. But again, the Holy Spirit's commentary here says that his faith was so great that he believed against all hope that God would still keep his covenant promise. Through Isaac, your offspring shall be named, and that he would restore the life of his son. Okay. Now, this is one of the greatest, what we call, types in the Bible. We've already discussed one type when we are discussing Melchizedek. So, types or typology. Okay? And when we speak of type, we also have antitype. And in the scriptures, most significantly, the antitype will be Christ. What typology is a way in which God, in his special revelation here, looks ahead to some great event and does so through a story or a person that at the time that it took place, people didn't see it as looking ahead to some greater fulfillment. Okay? In fact, at the time, it is in no way indicative of something that would happen in the future. Melchizedek is an example. Okay? But it prefigures something that did happen later on of great significance. And what happens later on, the antitype is Christ here. Okay? And after the coming of Christ, you can look back at some of these personages, some of these stories, some of these narratives, and see, oh, there are parallels here. There's a parallel to what God did foremost in his deliverance of us through his Son. What are some of the parallels in this story that is typological?
With the sacrifice of Christ.
He's sacrificing his only Son.
Okay. God does sacrifice his only Son. He gives his only Son as a covenant offering. Okay. Anything else?
You had the 3-day journey to get there.
Okay. 3-day journey. Okay. And according to, again, Hebrews, in a sense, Isaac was dead when Abraham decided, I will obey this. Isaac, in a sense, became dead to him. Okay. Figuratively speaking. So for those 3 days of that journey, Isaac was, in a sense, dead. Anything else?
Isaac has to carry all the stuff up.
Okay. Isaac carries the wood up to the top of the mountain. Okay. So it's kind of the image of carrying the cross, the instrument of his death. Okay. Anything else?
He got his son back. It was pretty much, he saw he was reborn.
Okay. So, receive the son back. The type of the resurrection. Good.
There's still a sacrifice in place of.
Okay. So there still is a sacrifice. God provides. And that place was then named, God will provide. God still provides the sacrifice. And he does so ultimately in Christ. Okay, excellent. Good connections you've made there. There's one other significant one, and that is that the Lord directs Abraham to go to Mount Moriah. To make this sacrifice, Mount Moriah. And in, I don't remember if it's 1st or 2nd Chronicles, Mount Moriah is identified as Mount Zion. So this is the same place where the temple will be built, where the sacrifices will be made, okay, including the sacrifices for the Day of Atonement. And it's also the same mountain or hill system, an outcropping of this Mount Moriah is what we would call Mount Golgotha, okay, Mount Calvary. So, the same place where sacrifice takes place, ultimately the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Yep. Right. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. So already in. Genesis, here we see that. Okay, so he's received back. Genesis then continues with the death of Sarah in chapter 23 and her burial. Her burial kind of in the south of Canaan
near Hebron, or Hebron, a place called Machpelah. Machpelah. And Abraham purchases a tomb and a field next to the tomb from a Hittite. And this then now becomes the place where Sarah is entombed. What is significant about this is that this is the only part of the promised land now that Abraham really possesses, this tomb. Tomb of Machpelah. Okay? So Genesis will end, and even at the end of Genesis, this is the only land of the promise here that is owned by the people of promise. They still remain sojourners, as Hebrews says. They're pitching their tents, they're moving here or there, they're nomads. But this is the one piece of land which becomes kind of a pledge piece of what will come. Okay, what will come. Okay, and so Sarah dies at the age of 127. In chapter 25, Abraham himself dies at the age of 175. After Sarah dies, Abraham does marry again, a woman by the name of Keturah. Keturah. And he has many wives, many sons through her. I think maybe six or seven. I don't remember exactly. One of them is named Midian. And he will be the ancestor to the Midianites in the area. You might recall in the book of Exodus that Moses marries the daughter of Jethro, who is the priest of Midian. And so he is a genuine priest of Yahweh, the Lord Most High. And he knows of Yahweh through his ancestry from Abraham, through Abraham's second wife, Keturah. Okay? So, that's pretty much the story of Abraham. Any questions or comments before we move on to the other patriarchs? Okay. Well, we've already seen here how Abraham moved from Ur of the Chaldees up to Aram, and then down to Canaan, and then back and forth from Egypt, but eventually then his burial place, or the burial place for Sarah and himself, is this plot of land, a field with a cave in it, Machpelah. It's the only land that is owned. Okay. What the rest of Genesis now will be to show how God's people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, land in Goshen. In the land of Goshen. And all the way back in Genesis chapter 15, we didn't look at this, but remember that covenant ceremony of the splitting of the animals and the going through the blood? God said to Abraham that his descendants would not possess the land until after they had, first of all, been enslaved in a foreign land. So God himself says it's not in your lifetime, not even the lifetime of your son and so forth, but Your descendants, before they possess this land, will first of all be enslaved, treated badly in another land. So it's a foretelling of the oppression in Egypt. But the rest now of the book of Genesis really talks about eventually how do they get here in Egypt. And tomorrow we'll talk about what was God's intentions with their being there in Egypt. Okay? Now we also have the settling of these territories by the various Semites who are related to Abraham. Okay? So the Canaanites were already in the land. They're actually the descendants, not of Abraham or even of Shem. So they are not Semites themselves. They are descendants of Ham. Ham's son was named Canaan. But they were already there when Abraham arrived. But now there are these other people groups that are associated with Abraham. The Ammonites and Moabites, those were the born of the incestuous relations between Lot and his daughters. Okay, so they are right in this region. The Edomites will be the descendants of Esau, who will be one of Isaac's sons. The Ishmaelites, well, we've already seen Ishmael, and he is the first son of Abraham, born of the handmaiden Hagar. The Midianites then, also Midian was a son of Abraham by his second wife, Keturah. And the Amalekites then are also descendants of Esau, who will be Abraham's grandson. Okay, so here you have some of the lineage, tribal lineage of the patriarchs, and you have somewhat of a family tree that's given as you go through the handout that you received here, each one with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jacob's sons. This kind of puts it all together, and we'll be talking about the lineage. But you're going from Noah here, Terah, the father of Abraham, three sons of Terah. Abraham then has three sons that are significant. He had others as well with Keturah later on, but Ishmael, Isaac, and Midian. But it's through Isaac that the promise will continue on, the promise of the blessing. Okay? Isaac now will have two sons, Esau and Jacob, born to Rebekah, who is also related to Isaac. Okay? Rebekah is the granddaughter of Abraham's brother. Okay? So just you can see that Abraham had a son, Bethuel. He had a daughter, Rebekah, and a son, Laban. So these two are brother and sister. Laban will become important later on because Jacob, the son of Isaac and Rebekah, will go back and marry two of Laban's daughters, Leah and Rachel. Okay? And then the sons of Jacob, or the sons of Israel, who become then the tribes of Israel, are the sons of Leah, Rachel, and then also two concubines, Rachel's maidservant, Bilhah, and Leah's maidservant, Zilpah. So I know this is kind of complicated, but for some reason or another, the exams want you to know some of these relationships. Consider that important. Particularly, Rebekah, okay? How is she related to Abraham and thus to Isaac? What's the relationship connection there? And the connection here is that she's the granddaughter of Abraham's brother. So, let's talk about Isaac. Okay? Isaac now is the son through whom the promise line continues of Abraham. We've already seen that he was the one who was to be offered up for sacrifice on Mount Moriah. And after Sarah dies, Isaac still is not married. And Abraham does not want him to marry any of the local Canaanite women. And so he sends his trusted servant, Eliezer of Damascus, who, if you might remember, was the one that originally was to be the heir, okay? This distant relative of Abraham's was to be his heir, but trusted servant, back up to the home territory here, Haran, to find a wife for Isaac, okay? And Eliezer then comes up there and asks the Lord for guidance, kind of a sign to whom he should bring back as a wife for Isaac. And he encounters here Rebekah, who is the sister of Laban. Okay? And so what you have, in a sense, is this ancient Middle Eastern custom of the matchmaker. Okay, once again, out at the Muni, there's the fiddler on the roof, and matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Eliezer the servant is sent to be the matchmaker for Isaac. And he's sent by the father, Abraham. Isaac doesn't send him, Abraham does. Marriages are arranged here, pretty much. Okay? So, she agrees to go back, and when Eliezer presents her to Isaac, Isaac's got stars in her eyes, his eyes. He immediately falls deep in love with her, and they are married. And everything looks very romantic and wonderful between the two of them. Okay? That's about all that is said about Isaac, other than there are instances that we're not going to take time to look at here where the Lord appears to Isaac and reconfirms the covenant with him. Says, just as I made this covenant with your father, Abraham, I make it with you. I continue it with you. You will be the one through whom the promise will be carried out. These promises will be carried out. So the covenant is reconfirmed with him. Okay? Jacob then, the story of Jacob is given to us in chapters 25 through 35. And he is a very significant personage in the patriarchal narrative. Okay? He now is the son of Isaac and Rebekah. And he is one of two sons of Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac breaks the mold here of Abraham in that Isaac has only one wife, Rebekah. He has no other concubines, okay, no other children through other women, maidservants or whatever. And when Rebekah dies, he does not remarry. So they have two sons, Esau and Jacob, who are twins, okay? And already, even before they are born, there is conflict within her womb. They're wrestling and tussling and bustling, and she's already stressed out. What is happening? What's going on inside of there? And so there's a revelation to her that there are two sons, and that they will always be kind of competing with one another, wrestling with one another. But the promise is made even before the sons are born that the older will serve the younger. So this is again a break in that law of primogeniture, that the one who will prevail and will receive the promise will be the younger one. Okay? Well, when the two sons are born, the one son is born and he's very ruddy, red-colored, and hairy. And so His name is Esau, given the name Esau, which means hairy. Okay, not like, you know, hairy, H-A-R-R-Y, but H-A-I-R-Y, hairy. And his alternate name is Edom, E-D-O-M, which means red. Okay, so that's kind of his other name. And so he will be the father of the Edomites that we'll hear a lot about here later. Okay, Jacob is born, and although Esau comes out first, Jacob, little infant son, is grasping the heel. Kind of like, I'm going to, won't let you out first. Again, it's going to let me first, me first. And this is then indicative of the relationship between Jacob and Esau thereafter. It's always this kind of competition between them of who's going to receive the blessing. The fact is, however, God has already identified who's going to receive the blessing. It's the younger. Okay, and yet Jacob always tries to make it happen by his own means instead of simply trusting the Lord and trusting what the Lord has already determined and has promised. In terms of these two sons, Esau becomes Jacob's favorite. Isaac's favorite, I'm sorry. The father's favorite son is Esau. Jacob becomes the mother's favorite, Rebekah's favorite. Okay, so already you have a kind of dysfunctional family going on here with favoritism between the two. And this causes not only competition between Esau and Jacob, but also between father and mother, between Isaac and Rebekah. Rebekah is always taking the side of Jacob, and Isaac is always favoring Esau. Okay, so here you have the two twins being born. And Jacob now is intent on receiving the blessing and the inheritance. These are two distinct things. The inheritance is the birthright, okay? The birthright. And the Hebrew word for that is Bekara. The birthright. And again, according to the law of primogeniture, the older son was to receive this birthright. The birthright essentially consisted of 2/3 of the inheritance. So the oldest would always get 2/3 of what the rest would get. Okay, the other sons would have to divide up what was left, but the oldest would always get 2/3 of the total pie here. And Jacob now is intent on receiving that inheritance, the birthright, from the law of primogeniture. And the story that we were discussing earlier here was that Jacob tricks him. And by the way, the name Jacob also means trickster or deceiver. We talk about, you know, you're pulling my leg, you're tricking me. It's the same kind of idiom, or similar, I should say, idiom in the Hebrew. And it's the sense of grabbing someone's ankle and tripping them up. You trip them up. You deceive them. You trip them. And the trickster here, the deceiver, Jacob, is trying to trick his brother. His brother comes home from the hunt, and his brother's a real burly, manly kind of guy, hairy, you know, into contact sports and hunting and fishing and all that kind of stuff. And that's why his dad is particularly fond of him. And he comes home from a hunt, and he's famished. And so Jacob makes a pot of porridge, some stew, and says, I'll give you this food if you'll trade it for your birthright. And Esau sells his birthright for a pot of porridge. And this becomes almost, you know, enigmatic of foolishness here, kind of the epitome of foolishness. And so it becomes kind of a stereotypic reference to the fools who will sacrifice what is especially valuable for immediate gratification. So the birthright then is passed on. Whether or not Esau really thought it would happen, it happened. And it's honored, that transfer of the birthright. So Jacob has received that, but there still is the blessing, okay? And the word for blessing is barakah. Okay. So you've got Bekarah and Barakah, two words that sound very similar, but they are different. The blessing is the performative word that the patriarch would pass on to the son. And this is especially important now in terms of the covenant with Abraham, because this will be the line, the blessing of the line through which God's ultimate blessing will pass, okay? The promised blessing of the covenant with Abraham. And Jacob, being the ambitious scoundrel that he is, although at the prompting of his mother, Rebekah, puts on this guise. Isaac now has become doddering and somewhat senile, almost blind. He can't really see. And so Jacob now puts wool skins on his arms to make him seem like he's hairy, and puts on, you know, Esau's clothing to make him smell like he's Esau, and probably tries to lower his voice to make him sound like Esau. And with the collaboration of his mother, tricks Isaac into giving him the blessing. Isaac thinks that as he touches the hairy arms and smells the clothing, perhaps hears the voice, he thinks this is Esau. And he proclaims the blessing. The word of blessing goes forth. And it's like an arrow. You just can't, once it goes out, you just can't pull it back. It has performative force. In other words, it actually accomplishes what goes forth. Like God's word, when it goes forth, it accomplishes its purpose. So when he speaks the blessing, it accomplishes the purpose. Now the line of blessing will be upon Jacob, although Isaac thinks that it's going to be Esau, it will fall upon Jacob. Okay? So God's intentions, God's will is done. What he said even before the boys were born, the older will serve the younger. And this is a sign of God's election. Later on, one of the prophets speaks of Esau and Jacob, and he's really talking now more about the descendants of Esau, like the Edomites, compared to descendants of Jacob, the Israelites. And the prophet speaking the word of the Lord says, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. Okay. And it's not the sense that God hates people, but it's a comparative. The context indicates it's a comparative relationship here. It's the issue of election. God has elected now to pass on the blessing through Jacob. St. Paul develops this in Romans chapter 9 when he's talking about the doctrine of election as well. But here we're seeing it played out in very, very concrete terms with Esau and Jacob. And the interesting thing is, Jacob is using all kinds of deception and collusion with his mother, and yet in spite of that, which is sin, God works his will. God works his will of election in spite of that, and in many ways through it. So God's will not be thwarted even by sin. Okay? So what happens now is Esau finds out about this, and his temper rises to boiling. Not only has he been tricked out of the inheritance, the birthright, but now he's also been tricked out of the blessing by this trickster. And so he is intent to do Jacob in, to kill him. Rebecca learns of this, and so she says, "Jacob, get out of here. Your life is at risk." And she says, "Go back to Haran, to my people up there, and live with them. Find a wife there, but return back there. Get out of here." And so Jacob flees. En route, not far, because they had been down in this region, not far, he rests at a place that becomes Bethel. He names it that. And the story here is that of Jacob's ladder. You ever sung the song, "We are climbing Jacob's ladder"? Okay. What's the significance of this? Jacob lays down on a rock that becomes kind of a pillow, and he has a dream, a vision, of a ladder. It's really more of a stairway to heaven, okay? With angels ascending and descending that stairway, and the Lord in his throne at the top. And so Jacob himself does not ascend. They are connecting with him. And the Lord speaks to him from his throne, and he says, "I'm going to be with you. You're trying to make it on your own. You're trying to succeed by hook and crook. Just trust me. The covenant promises that were with your grandfather Abraham and your father Isaac are with you. I will take care of you. Trust me." Okay? Just rest on me instead of trying to do it by your own might and hook and crook. Okay? And that's the vision. Well, Jacob wakes up, and he names this place Bethel, which means in the Hebrew, house of God. He recognizes this is the connecting place between heaven and earth. Okay, right here. This is the place where God has connected on earth. And so it's a sacred place and a place of remembrance of God's promise of his covenant. And he turns this stone up as a memorial, reminder that this is the place where God appeared to him, and God has made this promise to him that God would be with him. This is the house of God, Bethel. There's some significant developments later on regarding this stone. In the time of the first temple, okay, Solomon's temple, we'll be getting to that here. The innermost room, the Holy of Holies, the most holy place, contained the Ark of the Covenant. Remember Indiana Jones, Ark of the Covenant? The Ark of the Covenant is the throne of God. It's the place where God made his dwelling, made his presence known. In 587 BC, the temple is destroyed, and the Ark is not heard of since. Thus the Indiana Jones movie, you know, where's the lost Ark? What happened to it, no one knows. Probably was destroyed. When Herod then built the temple, what would they put in the Holy of Holies? what would they place there? The ark was gone. What would be there in the most holy place? And you can read this in Albert Edersheim's books on the temple. What they decided upon to place there was, in fact, this stone. Okay? They went to Bethel, got that stone, put it in the Holy of Holies. Because it's the second best thing to the Ark of the Covenant, of some kind of physical object that is the place where God connects, where God is present. Okay. Now, this is also significant because in the early chapters of John, I think it's even in John chapter 1 or maybe chapter 2, when Jesus is calling the disciples, he calls Nathanael. Okay. And Nathanael recognizes him immediately as something special. Okay. And Jesus affirms the confession of Nathanael. It's almost a messianic confession. Jesus affirms that. And he says, you will see now the angels descending and ascending upon the Son of Man. In other words, he refers back to this image of the experience of Jacob. And he says, in the past, that stone, which is now in the temple, was the connecting place between heaven and earth. But no longer will that connecting place be the temple or the stone in that temple. The connecting place is me. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Jesus now is the place where God and man are reconciled, where there's a connection between God and man. So there's this fulfillment there. Okay, well, ultimately, Jacob does get up to Haran, and he comes across a lovely young maiden who is needing to give drink to her sheep, and she can't lift the stone, and so he, as a true gentleman, lifts the stone, shows he's no namby-pamby himself, even though he was oftentimes in the kitchen cooking stew and stuff instead of being out in the woods hunting game. But he can move the stone, and her name is Rachel. Okay. And he immediately becomes starstruck with her and falls in love. And lo and behold, she is the daughter of his mother's brother. So she is his cousin. Okay. So Rebecca was married to Laban. She's the daughter of Laban. And so she's from the good folk. She's from the good family. Okay. So this would make mother very happy. You know, oftentimes parents send their kids off to a Concordia University to make sure they, you know, get married to the right folk or whatever. Here Rebecca's sent him off, and he's going to get married to the right person. However, once again, it's the patriarch who decides who marries his daughter. And the patriarch, the father of Rachel, is Laban, and Jacob has met his match now when it comes to deceivers, comes to swindlers. Laban carries that gene as well. Okay? And Laban does a switcheroo on Jacob. He says, yes, you can marry my daughter, Rachel, but of course there's a price. The price is that you have to work for me for 7 years. Okay? Well, Jacob says, I love her so much, I'll do that. And the Bible says that those 7 years went by as fast as a day or so in his experience, because he had such love for Rachel. And the day of the wedding comes, and for the wedding, the bride was always veiled, okay? I don't know if you've seen some of these depictions of Middle Eastern weddings, and ancient weddings, but she's veiled. And so the wedding takes place, the consummation takes place on the wedding night, and on the morning after, Jacob wakes up and looks over at his new bride. Ah! Who's this? This isn't Rachel. And it was Rachel's sister, Leah. Now, Jacob had really no eyes on Leah or intentions for her.
He didn't know that night.
Yeah, right. So he comes stomping to Laban saying, "What have you done? You know, you tricked me." And Laban, he has a reason for this. He says, "Oh, didn't you know? Don't you understand? It's our custom here that the older daughter always has to get married before the younger daughter." So he acted as if, you know, "Oh, you should have known this. This is just the tradition." Okay, well, now Jacob is married to Leah. And Leah's kind of the ugly, not stepsister, but not, you know, the most desirable woman for him. So he says, "I still want Rachel." Okay? That's what we agreed on. So Laban says, "Okay, you can marry Rachel, but you'll have to work for me 7 more years." Okay? "But I'll make you a deal. I'll let you, instead of working 7 years and then marry her, you can marry her, but then you have to pay it off in the subsequent 7 years." So Laban gets Jacob to work for him for 14 years, and Jacob gets out of that 2 wives, Leah and Rachel. Rachel's the younger, she's the one he wanted. Leah is the older, he didn't really desire her. And I have deep sympathy in many ways for Leah, because she was always, in a sense, wanting Jacob's love and tried to earn that love through producing children for him, sons for him. But she was never the one that he really desired or loved. Okay? So now he's got 2 wives, and they each have concubines, maid servants that assist them, there's a competition between these 2 wives. Okay, there's the kind of deal, and it's probably Leah there and Rachel there, Laban and Jacob. Okay, so you've got Jacob now, who married Leah and Rachel, and they produce sons. Leah produces 6 sons here, and 1 daughter, Dinah, okay? And Rachel appears to be barren. By the way, Rebecca was also at one time considered barren, but then the Lord opened her womb so that she could have children, okay? But Rachel appears to be barren as well, unable to have children. And so she says to Jacob, "You use my concubine, Bilhah, and she'll produce children in my stead for you, so that I can, you know, provide you with children through her." Sounds similar. We've heard that theme before. Okay, so then Bilhah produces 2 sons, Dan and Naphtali. And at this time then, Leah, for some reason, isn't able to produce children. So she becomes more jealous, and she says, "I want to provide you with more sons, Jacob, so you use my maidservant, Zilpah." And it's kind of a trying to one-up each other, okay? And so 2 sons are produced through them. Now, these will then be called the Leah tribes, as you can see. So you've got 8 from Leah, and you've got 4 through Rachel, because eventually the Lord opens the womb of Rachel, and she is able to have 2 sons. The oldest is Joseph, the youngest is Benjamin. Rachel dies, giving birth to Benjamin. And in fact, she names him Ben-Oni, son of my affliction. But Jacob, who really has the ultimate authority in naming, says, nope, that won't fly. So he gives him the other name, Benjamin, son of my affliction, son of my right hand. He changes that. Okay, so you need to understand here the kind of conflict that's going on. But these then become 12, the 12 sons, who then become really the ancestors for the 12 tribes of Israel, in a sense, because there's going to come a change in that as well here, with the 2 sons of Joseph actually become the 2 tribes, half-tribes they're called, of Israel. So there's no tribe of Joseph. There are 2 half-tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, the 2 sons of Joseph through his Egyptian wife. Okay, so this is the situation then. Eventually, Jacob returns from up in the north country, going back to Canaan, with a large family, as you can see here. 2 wives, 2 concubines, 12 sons, 1 daughter, Dinah, and he has become extremely rich. The Lord has blessed him greatly. And they kind of leave under cover of night while Laban is away. And Laban comes back and finds this out and chases after him. Because Laban does not want Jacob to go. Jacob, because of God's blessing upon Jacob and Laban's association with Jacob, Laban has become very, very wealthy, and now he sees his golden goose leaving, and he's not wanting that. However, they meet, and they actually establish a covenant between them, and Laban then gives permission for Jacob to continue on. Okay, Jacob then comes down south, and he sends some of his men into Canaan to find out whether or not Esau is going to receive him. And they come back, said, yeah, Esau's going to receive you. He's coming after you with an army of 400 plus men. And Jacob panics. And once again, as we've seen before, he is not so much a man of great faith. He's always trying to do it himself. And the Lord had said, I will take care of you. Remember at Bethel, he said, I'm going to provide for you. But Jacob panics. And he pleads with the Lord. This is a good thing. At least he turns to the Lord. He says, Lord, you know, you promised. Now act on your promise. Deliver me. My brother's coming. And he's going to massacre us. That's the expectation that he has. So he pleads to the Lord. An angel appears to him. And again, the indication here is that this is the angel of Yahweh, the Melech Yahweh, the Malach Yahweh, angel of the Lord, who is in fact God. Okay, the pre-incarnate Christ, some would say, but God appears in physical form to him. And they have a wrestling match. Okay? A wrestling match. And they wrestle all night. My 2 sons love to wrestle. But they won't wrestle all night. Jacob and the Lord wrestle all night. Okay? Finally, the Lord, again showing that he's the Lord, I mean, he's just kind of playing along with this. He touches Jacob's hip and puts the joint out, just with a little touch. Okay, showing his power. And in other words, the match is done now. Jacob, you've been wrestling with me all your life. You've been struggling with me. why don't you just kind of let go and let me take care of it? And so it's kind of like, okay, the match is done. But Jacob, remember, he is the heel clasper. He holds on, and holds on to the leg, dragging there, you know. And he says, I will not let go of you unless you bless me. Bless me. Remember, he's always seeking after the blessing. Okay. And in one sense, that's commendable, that he's seeing the Lord as the source of his blessing. But on the other sense, the Lord's already blessed him. Okay, the Lord's already given him the blessing. The Lord's already promised that. Okay. And so he doesn't have to clamor for it. But the Lord obliges and provides him with the blessing here. And at that point, Jacob's name is changed. It's changed to Israel. Israel. And the name Israel means he wrestles with God. He struggles with God. Okay, so this is his new name. It kind of shows then and prefigures what will happen with his descendants, who are continually wrestling with God, struggling with God in this covenant relationship that happens. So, at that then, Jacob meets with Esau, and instead of going at blows with one another, Jacob gives him a big bear hug, embraces him, kisses him even, welcomes him back. Okay, my brother. So the past is forgotten. Everything's peaches and cream right now. But this doesn't mean then that, I mean, Jacob's no dummy. And he doesn't then just kind of move in with Esau. They're back in Canaan, but they also, he knows, we need to live in a different area than Esau had. But there is the reconciliation between the two brothers at that point. Okay? Any comments or questions about Jacob or Israel? Okay, in the remaining time now, then, we'll talk about Joseph. And this is the last part of the book of Genesis, a very familiar story, no doubt, to you. Maybe you've even seen the Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice musical, Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, a very creative depiction of this story. But you remember now that you've got these 12 sons of Israel, and they are identified according to primarily the two mothers, the Leah tribes, and then the Rachel tribes here. And because Rachel was the favorite wife of Jacob, Rachel's firstborn son, Joseph, is his favorite son. So once again, dysfunctional family in one sense with all kinds of favoritism going on, and Joseph is the recipient of that. And Joseph himself, I mean, he eats it up. There's some indication here that he isn't the most tactful person in this whole process starting out. Okay? You know the story of the technicolor dream coat, the multicolored coat that Jacob gives to him. And there's some indication from some of the commentaries that I've read that this is the pledge that Jacob was making to Joseph that he would receive the birthright, the inheritance, as the firstborn of the favored wife. Certainly not the firstborn. Okay, Reuben is the firstborn from Leah, but the firstborn of the favored wife, then, that he would be the one who would receive the inheritance. And then you've got Benjamin down here as well, the second son through Leah. Okay? Joseph, of course, is the dreamer and has many dreams. And he, in a way, not so tactfully, tells the dreams to his brothers and family. And one of them is that the 11 other sheaves of grain, his brother's sheaves, bow down to his. Okay? And the other 11 stars bow down to his star, even the sun and the moon, the father and mother there. Okay? Well, they understand that these dreams are his thoughts, that he will reign supreme over them. He's already received this beautiful coat, the sign of the inheritance, and so they are jealous. And when he's away to them, kind of even perhaps spying on them, sometimes his father would send Joseph to go and spy on the brothers, see if they were really doing the work they were supposed to be doing. They grab him and say, well, here's the dreamer. And first of all, they throw him down into a pit, a well, intent just to let him die. But Judah is the one who kind of comes a bit to Joseph's defense and says, no, let's not kill him, let's not kill him. And so they say, well, we can make some money off of him. And here comes a caravan of Ishmaelites. So they sell Joseph as a slave. And he's taken away to Egypt, sold to Potiphar, a rich aristocrat in Egypt. And Joseph quickly distinguishes himself as a very capable and able worker, and so he's promoted to being the chief steward, manager of Potiphar's household. But not only is Joseph esteemed by Potiphar, the man of the house, but he's also esteemed by Potiphar's wife, who is not named in the text, who has eyes on him. The text says that Joseph was very attractive in body and face, and she was one who wanted that body and that face for herself, and so she essentially entices him, tries to lure him to commit adultery with her. And ultimately gets him into her bedroom and says, come lie with me. And he responds, how could I sin against your husband this way and sin against God? And I'm sure she was thinking, well, what's God got to do with this? But it shows proper theological perspective that Joseph has. So he simply flees, but she grabs his robe, his tunic, and she's got evidence, okay? And now she's going to frame him. She cries, rape, and Potiphar believes her, and so Joseph then is thrown into prison and left there to languish. While he's in prison for many years, okay, many years in prison, it seems like God has deserted him, and yet God continues to demonstrate that he is with him in this ability to interpret dreams. And again, that was an indication in the Near East that you were in fact being honored by the gods if you could interpret dreams. And he's able to interpret dreams. He does so for two other prisoners. The cup holder of the king, the butler, if you will, a very trusted person of the king, because the cup oftentimes could be poisoned and the king could be assassinated, so this person had to be trusted, but for some reason he had fallen into the king's disfavor. And so he's there, and also the king's baker. And they both have dreams, and they ask Joseph to interpret them, and Joseph does, and he says, it's good news for the butler. The dream indicates that you will be released and you will return to your service to the Pharaoh. Bad news to the baker. You're going to lose your head. Sorry, but you know that's what the dream, my interpretation says. And so you can see the reactions of the two here. Well, sure enough, that's what happened. The butler was released. And when he was being released, Joseph said to the butler, don't forget about me. Get me out of here. Don't forget me. But the butler then, when he gets back into his high-style living, does forget about Joseph. And Joseph languishes another 2 years in prison. Okay? But the Pharaoh then is plagued with dreams. And none of his wise men are able to interpret the dreams. And so he's in search for someone to interpret the dreams. The butler says, oh yeah, I remember a guy in prison. He interpreted dreams and they all came true. Let's fetch him. And so Joseph is summoned, and I mean, he's no dummy. He doesn't come in there looking like a ragamuffin guy right out of prison. You know, he shaves and cleans and everything, comes before the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh then tells him the dream. We're going to see a short clip now of that. Well, quite a change of fortune for Joseph here. Now he becomes second in authority and rule only to Pharaoh himself. He's highly esteemed in Egypt, and what he predicted comes true, the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. Again, most likely the drought reached all the way up into the African continent, and the source of the Nile also dried up. But the drought also affects the people in Canaan, and so everyone knows, just like Abraham had done before at time of famine, go to Egypt. They've got grain. And in fact, what happens is Joseph's brothers then return or come to Egypt for grain. Joseph recognizes them and tests them, okay? He tells them to go back. He asks, do you have any other brothers? They say, yes, there's Benjamin, but he's back with Dad in Canaan. He says, well, you need to, if you want to get, I'm going to hold captive one of the brothers, Simeon. If you want him to be released, you need to come back with your youngest brother, Benjamin, and then you'll get the food as well. Then I can trust you. Okay, they bring Benjamin, this is very hard for Isaac. He lost his favorite son, Joseph, and now his other son by Leah is taken away as well. So they promise, we'll bring Benjamin back to you. And so they do so, and Joseph says, well, you've kept your word. Let's have a feast here. And then they go on their way, and Joseph sends his guards after him and says, arrests them and says, one of you has stolen my treasured golden cup, and let's search him. They search the bags, and lo and behold, the cup is in Benjamin's bag. Now, Joseph had it planted there. He's testing them, these brothers. And so he says, you all can go, but Benjamin must stay. Benjamin will be made a slave. And the brothers then fall down, beginning with Judah, and say, no, not us. Not Benjamin. Take me instead. And with that, Joseph recognizes here that they will stand up for their brother. They are now men of integrity. And so he reveals himself to them and reveals himself as their brother and forgives them. I mean, it's a great gesture of forgiveness for what they did to him. Okay? So he is reunited with them, reconciled to them, and then he sends them back to bring Isaac back to, I'm sorry, Jacob, yeah. Getting late, my mind's kind of fizzling here. So Jacob back, thanks for that correction. And so they are now being settled in Goshen. And Jacob now is old, and he gives blessing to the various sons. In this case, you've got the blessing to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And in fact, Jacob, what he does is he puts his right hand on the younger, kind of switches. Joseph puts him so that he'd put the right hand on the younger and the left hand, or right hand on the older and right, left hand on the younger. Jacob switches hands, again showing God's will is not always according to custom and law, the blessing. And in chapter 49, you have Jacob's blessings of the other sons. The greatest blessing falls upon Judah. Even though he's not the firstborn, he receives the greatest blessing. And the promise that through Judah's line will come the rule, the ruler. Shiloh, the worthy one. Ultimately, the Messiah will come through Judah's line. Okay? And then Jacob dies in Egypt, but he is taken then and buried back in Canaan in that cave of Machpelah as well. So they're always taken back, their bodies were always taken back to Canaan, to the promised land, indicating their trust in the promise that this land will be theirs. This is where they will be buried. Later, Joseph in the Exodus, his mummy will be taken back to Canaan to be buried there too. So where we end now the book of Genesis is God's people, only a small parcel of land owned in Canaan itself, grave site, and God's people are located here in Goshen. And that sets the setting for the Exodus, and tomorrow we'll attend to that, the Exodus.